Every day, thousands of air traffic controllers keep the skies safe, guiding planes through takeoffs and landings and averting collisions. But it's day 25 of the government shutdown. For air traffic controllers across the country, that means it's day 25 of working without pay. On Friday, the National Air Traffic Controllers Association filed a lawsuit against President Trump and his administration. They charged that the shutdown has denied them pay without due process, making the group one of several government agencies to file suit over the shutdown.
Our inspectors, our technicians, our air traffic controllers, everybody that does their job day in and day out does the most important work ever. Safety of the flying public, right?
That was Professional Aviation Safety Specialist President Mike Perrone speaking at a rally at the Capitol Building in D.C. last week. Since then, furloughed federal aviation inspectors have been picketing outside of airports, and air traffic controllers have also been protesting. They even started handing out flyers yesterday about how the shutdown makes flying unsafe at airports serving Atlanta, Dallas, Raleigh, and Minneapolis. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega.
Good afternoon, sir. You're clear to
port. 101, there'll be a call battery for you. Alpha 6 is the gate.
Trish Gilbert is the Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. Trish, how is it going for air traffic controllers today?
Well, they're feeling a lot of anxiety, a lot of uncertainty, and it's a profession where you need 100% of your focus 100% of the time on the task at hand, which is ensuring the safety of flight. And unfortunately, when they're stuck in the middle of a political game or where somebody's trying to be a winner and it turns out those that are losers are the people just trying to do their jobs, and that's the people I represent. They're going to work, they're providing the service that they've all proudly want to do. Unfortunately, as they worked during the holidays, Christmas and New Year's, weekends, nights, they woke up, if they're not already at work, with zero in their paycheck for the work that they've done since the beginning of the year. One paycheck, I think most are, makes them nervous that it's gotten to this point. I think the real concern comes is the uncertainty and when the next one's going to come, how long will this last? The months and years statement has just caused a lot of anxiety in a workforce that doesn't need to have that distraction. They need to be focused on the job that they're really proud to do.
Tell us a little bit about the lawsuit. What are the goals of this suit? We know that Congress approved a measure to offer back pay to furloughed employees, but as you said, air traffic controllers, the check is showing $0. So what is the lawsuit and what are the goals?
Correct. The back pay is, I don't think those that are going to work, I know that they're going to get paid. They realize they're going to get paid. They just don't know when. Those that are furloughed and sent home and not allowed to work, that was, uncertainty there. And so Congress did pass that provision. It hasn't been signed into law by the president. So there is a little comfort there for those that were forced home. But the lawsuit is based on what we believe is a violation of the Fifth Amendment, which is there was no due process when property was kept from the people, and we believe pay is their property. Once they've performed the work, they are due that pay.
Well, and obviously there was, you mentioned the Fifth Amendment. There was an op-ed in the New York Times yesterday that encouraged TSA workers to strike. One of the things they brought up there in this op-ed was that these workers have a moral right to strike because of the things that you are pointing out, that they've been forced out of the jobs that they have been hired to do.
Well, I can't speak to TSA and the conditions they're working under. I imagine they're very similar. I know my workforce, and I know that to them, this is not just a job they report to every day. And I'm not saying that's the case with TSA. I'm just saying that my members and are proud to do the work that they do for this country. It's 5% of the gross domestic product for this country. It's an economic engine for this country, and they proudly do it. They're aviation professionals that believe in flight and what flight brings to this country, moving the military through the airspace, passengers, general aviation, business aviation, and most importantly, air ambulance. They know they need to be to work so people can get to where they need to be so this country can keep moving forward.
I understand, Trish. I'm wondering if because of all of those things, because of the dedication that you're outlining, because of the fact that these folks have not been paid, because of the Fifth Amendment clause that you mentioned, and also this idea of a moral right to strike, I'm wondering, does that push the union any closer to approving a strike?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. We would never endorse or condone any kind of action taken that would take our work and our skills away from the task at hand. Absolutely not.
Trish, what's the breaking point then?
Well, I think that's going to be different for every individual. You know, those that are in the lower pay scales that are not certified completely in the profession might look for employment elsewhere, especially in those living in high cost of living areas like Oakland, New York, Washington, D.C., Southern California. Those individuals will probably be the first to look for other things. I don't know how long different people are going to be able to go without a paycheck, but you can't expect it to last months and years. That people won't. They'll individually look for other employment. We already know of people that are looking for other employment. And we already know of people that are working second jobs at this point, which is really concerning because we are already 30-year low in staffing, meaning we have fewer fully certified controllers than we should, about 2,000. And they're working already mandatory overtime before this even occurred. So now they're working longer, and now not just longer providing air traffic control services, but driving Ubers before and after their shift. This is concerning to us, and it should be concerning to the American public as well.
And you also mentioned the staffing shortages. There is a shortage of air traffic controllers. 1 in 5 today are eligible to retire. Does that put an additional pressure on you all to kind of figure out what to do? Is there a question of trying to find new air traffic controllers? Are you looking at training for the folks who, as you said, you know, people can't go weeks and weeks and weeks without getting paid. So you could, I think, see more folks leaving the industry.
This is going to be long-lasting. Again, we were already short-staffed. Now they've closed our academy in Oklahoma City, which is where our new hired individuals start their career. They start their training. It takes 2 to 3 years to certify as a controller. So it's not something you can do overnight. It takes some time. And then you mentioned 1 in 5 are eligible to retire. And out of frustration, they might actually do that. And we're very concerned about that. So we will be feeling the effects of this long well after the government does open. But we certainly, it's not sustainable where we're at now. We're really going to have to work very, very hard to focus on training and hiring once we get out of this. Otherwise, the system will start to feel capacity issues. Those that fly will start to feel the delays in the system when we're not able to staff our radar rooms and our towers across the country.
I think we're already starting to see evidence of some of that with just social media photos and things that people are posting. You know, historically, I mean, there was a strike in 1981 of air traffic controllers that forced the country, I guess, to understand what their concerns were and what they did. Do you see any parallels with that strike in 1981 to what's happening today?
It's completely different. That was a disagreement between the union and their employer. This happens to be a disagreement between an administration and Congress, and has nothing to do with aviation. So we're kind of stuck in the middle. The members that I represent aren't partisan. Aviation's not partisan, and they don't have an opinion on this political argument that's occurring. They do expect their leaders, those that work for us in government, to figure this out. We expect them to get to yes, not to get to an impasse and stay at this impasse. If there was any kind of indication that they were getting closer together instead of further apart, I think our members could start to relax and focus better on their job.
I feel like this will be a redundant question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Where do air traffic controllers go from here? You know, given the standstill that you've outlined, and I think that we're all experiencing and witnessing, this feels like it could be a pretty severe blow to the industry.
It is. It could cause irreparable harm, and nobody wants that in aviation. We have the aviation industry is completely in line with opening the government and not hurting the system any more than they already than it's already been hurt. But where do we go from here? You know, we're talking to the media as much as we can. We're at airports across the country, 60 airports. Our air traffic controllers that are furloughed or they're going before or after work, and they're handing leaflets to the flying public, taking our message to them so they understand that this shutdown does affect the entire country. It does not just affect federal employees. The ripple effect to those that, you know, depend on the federal government being at full capacity, they're also impacted, and that's concerning as well. Eventually, we'll feel it throughout, but right now, our membership is taking that message to the airports. We've been on the Hill as well, meeting with our members of Congress. They're bringing their stories to them, their concerns to them, and we're asking them to act. We're asking them to end this shutdown today. It's just unreasonable to expect that people would go for months and years to work without receiving a paycheck.
Trish Gilbert is Executive Vice President of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. Trish, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Tanzina.
All right, your turn. Do you support protests or strikes by federal employees during the shutdown?
Hi, my name is Jonathan. I'm in St. Louis, Missouri. I absolutely support the federal workers for standing up for themselves. Being a federal government worker does not in any way dissolve their civil rights. They're still allowed to speak out. They still have First Amendment rights against their employer, even if it happens to be the government.
Hi, this is Natalie calling from Brandon, Florida, with regard to protests by government employees during the shutdown. I agree and disagree. I disagree if it jeopardizes the U.S. safety and security, but then I agree with their right to peacefully protest because it's protected under the First Amendment.
This is Mark from Beaverton, Oregon. This is a tough call, but these federal employees are real people who need to eat and everything else as well. The elected officials who run the government must understand the consequences of shutting it down.
Hey, this is Jess in Omaha. I would absolutely support the air traffic controllers putting a stop to working. It's a super high-pressure job with lives in their hands. The government shouldn't be shut down in the first place. So if the air traffic controllers want to also stop in order to pressure a government that seems to forget it's for and by the people, then so be it.
Peter Dumont, Berkeley, California. In general, I think too many people who do public service, sometimes as self-appointed volunteers for years on end, are taken far too much for granted.
Give us your take by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. Stay with us. We're going back for a moment to August 1981. With the government unwilling to meet their demand for a $10,000 raise, the Air Traffic Controllers Union decided to strike.
All of those opposed to returning to work and staying out for as long as it takes to get a fair an equitable contract, signify by saying yes.
Yes!
In saying yes, they defied a law that makes it illegal for federal employees to strike. Ronald Reagan was in the first year of his presidency, and he came out with a hard-line stance against the strike.
They are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
But the union held its ground. Thousands of air traffic controllers picketed on the streets instead of watching the skies. Robert Poley, the president of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association, or PATCO, responded.
They're trying to break the union. I think they are trying to use every intimidation factor that they can to get the controllers to go back to work. I certainly do believe that they're trying to break our union.
Reagan brought in supervisors and military controllers and got 80% of flights running again. He stood by his word and fired 11,000 air traffic controllers for striking. Many of them were banned from the profession for life. To learn more about the 1981 strike and the effects that it still has on air traffic controllers to this day, I spoke with Barbara Peterson, the aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Barbara is covering the shutdown and was also reporting on the strike back in 1981.
the system really was just dealt a body blow. Now, you have to remember the context, too. This was several years after airline deregulation. So there were new airlines popping up, new budget airlines that were offering low fares. And this almost put them out of business because basically the country's air traffic system had to contract by about 30%. The airlines were ordered just, okay, find the fat in your schedule and just cut it. So it took 3 years to get controllers trained and back in the jobs. They went up to about 9,000. And when you think that was down from 12,000, that's still pretty huge. And it took roughly about 10 years to really rebuild the system back to its previous capacity. But at the time, it was considered this pivotal moment, you know, because the president had said, you know, you're fired. We're not taking you back, no matter what. And when some controllers did want to come back, they were told no. They were actually barred from federal service of any type for years. So, you know, there's just nothing that we can even imagine today that would compare to that.
Of the air traffic controllers that are currently working today, about one in five or almost 2,000 folks are eligible to retire. Are those workers who started or who came in during the 1981 strike?
Well, they've gone through sort of several phases, I would say, since then. I mean, when you consider that it's almost 38 years ago, I mean, that was huge. And controllers can retire after 20 years or 25 years, depending on their age. And that means, you know, most of them do choose to do that. It's a very stressful job. There's a lot of burnout. And all of these issues, I think, are sort of ever present. And in the years I've been following this, the controllers have been at loggerheads with their employer, the Federal Aviation Administration, at many points. One of the lowest points actually happened during the administration of President George W. Bush. And they could not come to terms on a contract. And then when they really finally came at an impasse, the government imposed a pay freeze, and they imposed all sorts of work rules, and there was a lot of bad blood at that time. I remember there was a lot of discontent, and controllers were agitating them, but you know, they've always stopped short of calling for a strike because it's illegal. I mean, and you know, the memory of 1981 looms large.
This isn't the first time that air traffic controllers have sued during a shutdown. And as we mentioned earlier in the first segment here, this is not the first group of federal employees to sue the president and his administration for this shutdown. How effective are these lawsuits? Are they symbolic or do they actually have teeth?
Well, I think that what they do is they show, and at least for the rank and file anyway, what they're showing is that, yes, this is a really important job. And this is something where you can't keep on going with the same level of commitment, you know, if you don't know when you're going to get paid. I think it's a good way to get that message across. Now, I think that a lot of people believe that this can't go on much longer for a variety of reasons. So back to what the outlook is now is that this is having an impact on morale. I mean, how can it not, right? And we've seen in previous periods when the controllers and the FAA have been, you know, having contentious relationship, there's always going to be an impact. And we should be worried about that, I think, because already the controllers have been complaining about being short-staffed, that they don't have enough new hires coming in to fill the jobs that are opening up. You know, it takes about 5 years to get a controller really up to speed from when they start a training academy. So it's not something that where they can just rush in a bunch of replacements. And so really to get a fully trained workforce up, they, you know, it's going to take years. So I think what's happening now is that requiring these types of essential employees to keep on working without pay, it really is unprecedented. And so I'll leave it to the lawyers to come up with their own argument for that. But I would say that this does give them another, it's sort of a unique situation that might, you know, lead to something.
The other thing is, Barbara, is that we're seeing, I've read somewhere about the TSA workers specifically and how they're sort of calling in sick, as we've heard, to protest in that way. Do air traffic controllers protest in that way as well? I mean, is there sort of a blue flu, if you will, you know, resistance happening?
I haven't seen anything that would confirm that, though it has happened again in the past. There have been more like work slowdowns where you can really slow things down by the book, and that would also be a way of sending a message. So what I've heard so far is that the controllers still say, no, we, you know, we're professionals, we take this very seriously, we're responsible, we don't want to impact, you know, the system to the point where it affects safety. But, you know, when NATCA was formed, the current union NATCA, to replace PATCO, which of course was put out of business effectively by the 1981 strike, when they formed, they made a promise never to strike. That was one of the reasons why they were able to form a new union. So that still, I think, is an important influence in what their strategy is going forward.
Barbara Peterson is the aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Barbara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. We need your help if you like this podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're not already getting us every day. And tell your friends. Plus, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us in a big way, and it helps other people find us. As the 2020 presidential election approaches, newsrooms across the country are starting to assemble their political reporting teams. This past weekend, CBS News announced their group of 2020 reporters and producers, but it didn't go over well. Of the 12 reporters and producers named, a majority are white and none are black. But CBS is not the only news organization that has issues when it comes to having a diverse staff. A 2017 survey conducted by the American Society of News Editors found that minority journalists account for just 16.6% of newsroom staffs. Here at WNYC, where The Takeaway is produced, people of color make up 28% of our staff. So what's really at stake when newsrooms fail to represent the country they report on? We have some fantastic guests for you today. Ested Herndon is here. He's the national politics reporter for The New York Times. Hi, Ested.
Hey, how are you?
Thank you so much for coming. And we also have Darren Sands, national political reporter for BuzzFeed. Hi, Darren.
Hi, good to be with you.
All right, we have nothing to talk about, of course, right? Like, this is so not an issue. I feel like I've been talking about this for years. First, I want to get your reactions to the, well, I don't think it's a surprise, but your initial reaction to the tweet from CBS.
I knew the backlash was coming. I mean, this is something that, again, like folks have been talking about for a long time. And I think Twitter has finally allowed people to get their say in on these newsrooms and force these newsrooms to think about things that would have just existed in kind of silos before. And so I wasn't surprised. And I think as folks in this industry, we know how deep and real this problem is. But I was hoping that people would think about it more structurally, not just CBS, but as an industry-wide problem that has a lot of necessary solutions that I'm sure we'll get to.
We're totally going to get to that. Darren, what was your reaction when you saw that tweet?
My initial reaction was that I know that there are like black people behind the scenes at CBS News.
they're there, yeah, right? And just to be clear, this was not a whole staff, right? Yeah. This was just a Politics 2020 team.
Right, it's a specific team. And I think that that nuance needs to be brought to the conversation as well. But that image is a very important one to see, and I think that it's really just something that people sort of learn to jump on, mm-hmm. kind of when you see these images that are out there in social media that are sort of excluding an entire community, and people, that image gets out and it doesn't seem to like pass the right eyes to say that maybe we shouldn't do this. And I think that's part of like the issue too, is that they just don't see why that's not cool, you know.
And I want to bring that up because you're both making really critical points. I mean, the fact that we're all reacting to this is because it's an image, right? Mm-hmm. It was something that CBS put out, most likely with the good intentions. Mm-hmm. You know, there were some people of color in the staffing. But this thing about optics, right? And I think we often get sort of caught up in what makes sense, right? Often I think when news organizations are hiring, they're thinking about the optics, right? Do we need to have, you know, check off all these boxes of different reporters of color? this to me, and I say this all the time, diversity goes beyond optics. Can I hear someone back me up on that?
Yeah, it's much deeper than that. I mean, I think that there's two levels happening here. There's one, like, newsrooms are built on trust, and our ability to really get folks to read and believe what we're saying is built on trust. And I think optics matter for trust. I mean, I think that there are communities who want to see that there is someone in those rooms who come from their backgrounds, represent them, and have an ability, input on editorial decisions. So I think that that optics does matter. But then on a kind of practical level, it matters much more for just a moral feel-good thing, but actual journalism. I mean, there are things that people from communities and there are people that they listen to that they can put in story ideas, that they can change stories in a way that can be really powerful. I know at the Times it's something that comes up a lot. I mean, and something like a Democratic primary, which is what we're going to be talking about for the next year, Black voters are a central part of that. And so it's not just about feeling good. It's not just about having people warm and fuzzy, but actually doing the work necessary that I think communities rely on us for.
What about you, Darren? Why do you think that gets often, I feel like that gets lost in the conversation about diversity? Like, I think a lot of people think, well, I've got to check these boxes and fill the blank. It's deeper than that. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think at BuzzFeed, they really think about it as a business imperative to be serving all communities as much as you can. And, Jonah Peretti actually talks about this a lot. And I think that was important for a lot of us there to really take into account that we put our stories forth and not feel that we're being, typecast or that these important stories are important because they're American stories and they're not necessarily going
race stories.
Yeah, they're not like race stories or just like the Black stories. And I've stopped thinking that way like a long time ago about, and I think a lot of us sort of have this inner dilemma, and sometimes we talk about it, is whether or not we cover Black story after Black story and we sort of get, pigeonholed into a corner. Whereas I think now, I think for Ostead and myself, I think I can speak for him. You can certainly speak for himself. But I think that we see these stories as being central to the narrative this cycle. And we also see these stories as being really inherently American, because Black people are fully American.
We've been talking about that. I recall even the coverage of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. We were having to explain that Puerto Ricans are actually American citizens, right? Like, there's a real lack of what we consider an American story versus a Black story. I'm also curious about Black or Brown story, really. Mm-hmm. I'm also curious about the value proposition that's expected of journalists of color. And I'm wondering, I've worked in places where I've kind of had to be that backstop, that extra set of eyes, and you're both nodding, because I think we've all been there, right? Yeah. It's not just we don't do just our job, we do our job, and then something I call race whispering.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like like you're talking about, it's finding blind spots that the organization may be missing. And I think it's a real problem in the industry. You are asking minority journalists to do this unpaid labor that should be coming from the organization having a real institutional commitment to this. Mm-hmm. And so I think that everyone needs to make their own calculation. I understand the Black and Brown reporters who say, this is not my job, I am not paid for this, and I won't do this. I think that's totally fine. I'm of the opinion that I want to help in ways that I find manageable. And so if that requires me, back reading something, if that requires me doing other input, I kind of feel like, good karma will come back around. But I understand the people who say the opposite, because you're not paid for that. And that's just another burden and expectation on top of your actual job that can really weigh on folks in a unique way.
And Darren, I want to go back to the value proposition question too, because let's think about how many when I asked this question a couple years ago on Twitter in particular, where are my investigative journalists? Where are my political journalists? Where are my science journalists, healthcare? People of color in those beats are severely underrepresented. So it's not just the fact that we're underrepresented in newsrooms. It's that in these particular beats, we're underrepresented. Your thoughts, Darren, on what that does to political coverage?
I think a lot. I mean, I could talk a whole lot about that. But I think, I hope what this conversation does is take us to a point where we can be constructive about this dilemma in our industry, and it's not politics, it's science, it's the environment, it's all of these different beats that I think are just vitally important for Black people to be approached and our issues to be approached with nuance and understanding.
I remember having to tell someone once, I am not the Hispanic affairs reporter because I'm a Latina. I just happen to cover national issues, and they happen to do with race. So, I think we also have the responsibility, but outside of the fact that we provide a sounding board or our quote-unquote cultural expertise, you know, what are the other value propositions that we bring to the table? Because, Darren, you just brought up the AKA Kamala Harris situation. Remind our listeners what happened there.
Yeah, there was an event, I believe it was in D.C. Kamala Harris was being interviewed by a journalist on stage live, and there were lots of reporters tweeting it. And at some point or another, Kamala Harris, who's the senator from California and running for, presumably running for president, was introduced. And she usually does this thing where she talks about people who are in the crowd, and she does this really warm acknowledgement sometimes. And there were a lot of women from the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority in the crowd, apparently, who were there, and they have this call, basically, if you're in Greek life, it's called skiwi, and it's a very piercing sound.
Let's just be clear. I went to a state school in New York, and there were AKAs everywhere. Yeah. So, like,
I was in Wisconsin, and we still had AKAs.
Right, this wasn't like a secret society we're talking about here. Okay.
Right, and so obviously, right, public thing, and when they responded this way, the reporter from the Washington Post had tweeted that they began screeching. And I think that was just one of those points about like cultural nuance that we're talking about, where if you don't know necessarily what's happening, that as Black journalists, we are sort of given this like imperative that we need to be asking questions. Mm-hmm. And it seemed at that moment that it was sort of a glimpse at this idea that, you know, some white reporters, even if they don't know what's going on, that they're going to respond, like they're going to cover it the way that they see it and just kind of move on. And I think that people, readers in particular, were struck by that because, Black readers in particular, because they feel like they want to know that the reporters know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And that if they don't, that they are going to approach it with a sense of care and nuance. So something like that, for instance, something is really as personal that it feels like she's an HBCU, a product of an HBCU, and having pledged a Black sorority, that feels like really personal, I think. Even, I don't think you have to be an AKA to feel that in a way. Right. And so I think there was just like a level of insensitivity that was just transferred in that moment that kind of just, I think, is sort of this glimpse at what we're talking about. And I don't know. I'm curious, like, what you actually feel about that moment, because I know that, I mean, you had a lot to say, but.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to deeply insult another, like, just a person individually. Right, I think it's tough. I mean, one thing I will say is, you know, having been a Black reporter who covered crime in New England, you have to be very aware. We're kind of trained to know that our identity is impacting this situation and learning how to navigate that. And I think that sometimes something that white reporters like never have to go through, because they're often in situations where their identity is catered to. And so this is kind of a rare situation in which a national presidential candidate is having a hyper Black moment to say, you know, for lack of a better word, and that is actually just a glimpse into something that minority reporters go through all the time.
Right.
And so I think that that's speaks to the value proposition question. Is it's not just the obvious things. It's just that there is like a level of understanding how you as a person and as a reporter have to navigate situations that may not be your exact. You know, it may not be exactly what you're used to, because that's kind of how we operate through the world. And, you know, oftentimes or sometimes white reporters don't have that experience, and it can play out in these ways that I think really diminish trust. And I think, like, that's the pitch that I'm always making to, you know, editors and bosses. It's like, we have a trust problem. And
with who?
I think we have a trust problem with minority communities. And, like, I think we talk a lot about the Trump voter media trust problem.
Do you think they care? I think that there's a problem with people, communities of color? Because that really feels to be the question to me. Like, do they care?
I don't know. I think we should care. I think it's our moral responsibility to care are they our subscriber base, and is there a financial incentive to care is a whole separate question. But I think we are supposed to care. And so my pitch is always like, this is a community that distrusts us for legitimate reasons, for reasons in which we have failed over and over and over again. And so like doing
as
this
journalists.
As journalists, mm-hmm. and like doing this work, we're only asking us to apply our same journalistic principles to a community that has not seen the best of those. And so like when we fail, it really, really matters.
Yeah,
I mean,
it does.
And folks remember that.
What about the expectation of this level of, like you said, when you fail, it really, really has an impact, right?
Yeah.
Journalists of color, I feel, are not allowed the same space to fail. I feel as though there is a certain level of objectivity that we're expected to have that is not expected from other journalists. Am I wrong on this? I don't know. Like it's almost like there's a sense that if you're Black and writing a Black story, quote unquote, if you're Latina and writing a Latino story, can you really be objective? I don't see that same thing coming out necessarily with white reporters.
Oh, 1,000%. I mean, like, I can give you a vague, last midterms, I wrote a story about a Black candidate and their white opponent emailed the New York Times arguing that I was biased, frankly, because of no other reason except it was a Black reporter writing about a Black candidate. And that comes up all the time. There is an idea that, especially if you write about issues of race, or if you are writing about someone with a certain level of cultural sensitivity or understanding something about that Black candidate's background that is just more nuanced and contextual, that's actually bias and not just journalism. And it's partly, and I think we have to think about it in the inverse. Like, it is the reporters who are failing on race who are foregoing our journalistic principles, right? Like, it is not us. Like, we are doing the work. We are doing the job. Like, that, like, the folks who aren't talking about it are the ones who are contorting themselves to, like, not apply journalism to every community. Sorry, that was a big rant.
I was just going to say, are they also the ones using racially tinged?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
My favorite phrase.
You know, one of the things that I've learned, like, very, very, it's amazing to me, but, like, people don't like that word, racist.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's, like, is that on me? Like, whose responsibility is it to be, like, sensitive about race? You know what I mean? Like,
that's a great question.
Toni Morrison always talks about, you know, growing up and someone having told her, and she said this publicly, but talking about this idea that, like, racism isn't my problem. It's theirs.
Yeah.
And it really has become almost this pejorative, this untouchable pejorative that it's like, if you call something racist, that people get so offended by, and there's a performative aspect of this idea that you are sort of rejecting that you're racist or not. And I think it starts at sort of like at the top, right, with the president and this idea that he condemns racism in all of its forms, but has these kind of things that happen over the course of his presidency that we look at it and we're like, wow, that is wild racist. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, there's such a chasm between, like, where I think where we are as journalists and as reporters and how people think about, and that's why we have these conversations, right, about, like, you know, what is racist? What should we call racist?
Right.
What's racially tinged? What's, you know, I don't know. And I think we're getting to the point almost where we can start to call racially tinged racist because it's not calling it, you know, what it is.
Can I say one point on that? It's just like conservatives have changed the meaning. I mean, they changed the meaning of the word racist, right? They made it so that every use of racist was about a question of somebody's heart, that you had to know what was in their soul. Mm-hmm. But that's not the meaning of the word. I mean, the word has we actions can be racist, you know, language can be racist, and that, like, has nothing, that's not necessarily an indictment of the human being, but an accurate description of, like, words that come from an ideology that, you know, is based in white supremacy or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I think journalists have like intuitively adopted that conservative bias meaning of the word racist. And so that we are avoiding, we're avoiding using it as if it, again, is an indictment of some person's soul, when I'm not even asking you to say an individual's racist. I'm asking you to say that the actions are. I'm asking you to say that the language is. I'm asking you to like accurately describe what the baseline, the ideology at the center of it. And all of those things are things that I think we've gotten too scared to touch because, frankly, we've been spun by conservatives and the right who have made that an intention and made us so wary about doing that work.
Yeah. And, you know, to take it a step further, I think that a lot of the work comes in with this idea that, you know, I talked about how we create a constructive situation out of this CBS News thing. And I think that people need to have a sort of a come to Jesus moment about, you know, race and how we use a situation to have an honest conversation and then to have a conversation about how we fix those things. Because a lot of times when, you know, something happens, right, and we get to this point where, you know, we stop talking about it and then it goes away and then that's it.
And then we see a tweet.
Yeah.
Until the next time. And then like nothing ever happened. So like what are the mechanisms right now in place that we can sort of use to see, look at this situation, talk about why it's really messed up, talk about how we can build institutions and build on ideas that can help fix the problem. And then how do we move forward? And if we're not having that conversation about how we move forward from things and we're just like sort of, you know, churning the wheels on the outrage machine and just never really getting beyond that until the wheels aren't turning anymore, then I don't know. Like, I don't want to live in that society.
Astead Herndon is a national politics reporter for The New York Times, and Darren Sands is a political reporter for BuzzFeed, covering the 2020 elections. Thanks to you both for taking the time and joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all for us today. Thanks so much for being a part of the conversation. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. We'll see you tomorrow.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.